Hello and welcome to In Control, the first podcast on control theory. Here we discuss the science of feedback, decision making, artificial intelligence, and much more. I'm your host, Alberto Padoan, live from a recording studio in Zurich. Quick thanks to our sponsor, the National Center of Competence in Research on Dependable Ubiquitous Automation, as well as the International Federation of Automatic Control. Our guest today is Rodolf Sapulcra from the University of Cambridge. He's Professor of Engineering in the Control Group. Welcome to the show, Rodolf.
Thank you, and good morning, Alberto.
So I should probably give a small disclaimer that I've been spending a lot of time with Rodolf over 3 years in Cambridge some time ago in my past. It's been a pleasure to do so. And so it will be potentially a semi-different episode in the sense that I know you better than other people. And so having spent quite some time together, I know you are an avid reader and an avid hiker. So I guess just to break the ice, I'm curious about knowing what is on your reading list at the moment.
Wow, a very unexpected question. There are always many things on the reading list, but actually there is nothing on the reading list right at the minute, strangely enough. And often the best novels that I've read, I discover them by complete accident, for instance, in the bookstore of an airport. And so I like to be surprised, and sometimes this leads to the best reads.
So I'm curious. So, okay, one quote from one of your favorite readers is Orhan Pamuk, Nobel Prize in Literature in 2006. So he said, in The New Life, I read a book one day and my whole life was changed. So if that were to be the book, which one would it be for you?
Which book?
Yes.
That changed my life?
Yeah.
I don't think I could single out one book. Also because books, maybe it will be a strange answer to your question, but as a teenager, I was totally fascinated by Dostoevsky. And then there was a strange event that occurred to me when I was around 40, that one day I picked a book of Dostoevsky and I said, let's go back to it. And I stopped after 3 pages. And I realized at that time that the emotion that you can experience while reading a book is extremely dependent on your age, your environment, your stage in life. And so I think that it's not that certain books are objectively monuments. Of course, they are. But I think it's always a story of resonance. And so it's a resonance at a particular time for a special reason between the reader and the writer. That's how I would describe my experience with books.
Yeah. I actually love this answer because it kind of adds a dynamic element to a book. It's not something that is there forever, but it really has to be a synergy between the reader and the book itself.
It's always an encounter, yes.
Very fascinating. So since you mentioned you being a teenager, I like to always draw a sort of picture of your trajectory as a human. Yeah, so I'm curious about what brought you to control. So what is it about, say, your environment or your childhood or anything that you can think of that brought you to control?
That's very hard to answer. Again, I don't have a very clear answer. I can pinpoint events that eventually brought me where I am. But and so one event that I could tell about what led me to control, even though it has nothing to do with control, is that it was my second year of engineering, and it was the course of thermodynamics, which was definitely not my favorite subject at the time. But I remember very vividly that the professor once entered the classroom and was nearly shooting at us and saying, have you heard of what has just been reported, that for the first time ever, one has observed superconductivity above 30 degrees Kelvin, and that experiment will change the world? And he went on, and for the best part of the lecture, he just told us about these experiments and why it was fascinating and what would be the consequence of it. And I don't remember anything of what he told, but I do remember his eyes. And I do remember the light and I would say the fire during that lecture. And perhaps it is the moment in my life where I'm sort of experienced for the first time that there is such an intimate connection between teaching and research. And I would say that today I would pinpoint that event as something that led me to my profession, even though I'm sure that at that time, you know, it was just a complete accident. Perhaps this professor doesn't remember that he told those stories. Again, it is a sort of a resonance that is completely accidental. And I think of any trajectory as a somehow interpolating between those events. And those events are always independent of you. They are very accidental. So you could wonder whether how an identity can be defined by such stochastic events. But at the same time, I like to think that where I am today is not that dependent on those events, and that perhaps a completely different sequence of events would have led to a trajectory that would not be so different. And to me, this is a mystery of life, the fact that we are so much determined by accidental events. And at the same time, our own identity is not so much in these events, but how we respond to those events. And maybe this is my fascination for control theory, because after all, control theory is a science where you study the interaction between the external and the internal, and we study how systems respond to disturbances. And I find this quite deep and central to engineering, actually.
Yeah, and decision-making is the only lever that you can pull somehow.
Yes.
I mean, it's definitely fascinating. I guess the only comment I have is that in a sense, one cannot repeat the experiment as to the best of our knowledge.
Absolutely, yeah.
But yeah.
So we don't know who we would be with another sequence of events, but this is not something that causes me any anxiety, I would say. It's also a fact that all these events that I sort of would pinpoint today to define my trajectory always involve human beings and always involve encounters, those resonances that I was talking about earlier. I cannot remember reading a book or reading a text and saying, this is going to change my life. But I can pinpoint a sentence that someone told me and that somehow became very important in my life, yeah.
That changed the course of events, in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess one of the things that I really want to mention is that, you know, by interacting with you over the years, one of the things I learned from you is an appreciation for the history of a problem. And so I found a very nice quote from Kepler, from the Astronomia Nova. So he says, "The roads by which men arrive at their insights into celestial matters seem to me almost as worthy of wonder as those matters themselves." So today I would like to try and draw, you know, your trajectory. You started from, at least academically speaking, from a paper with your PhD advisor, Stability for Dynamical Systems with First Integrals, a Topological Criterion. So something very mathematical and very much rooted in nonlinear control. And today I would say that your manifesto, that we will talk about certainly in a second, is towards building spiking control systems. So how do we connect these two points? What happened in the middle?
Yeah, again, it's a very strange sequence of events, and the events don't really explain the outcome. But I think that control theory requires a lot of mathematical abstraction. And at the same time, I think that control theory, to me, is really engineering driven. So the important contributions of control have always come from very concrete engineering questions. And it is this meeting point between the abstraction and the concreteness of the questions that attracts me and that I think has always attracted me in control. So my engineering education was quite mathematical. In fact, my specialty was mathematical engineering. if such a thing exists. So definitely I had a taste for mathematics, as I think many people in Cantal have. But over the years, I became more and more sympathetic to the concreteness of Cantal. And this is also what I like about the basic Cantal courses, is that it's hard, I think, to pinpoint other courses early in the curriculum where there is such a bridge made between, you know, the very concrete questions of making the speed of a motor insensitive to load and complex analysis. How comes that those things connect to each other? How comes that a little bit of abstraction is so powerful in providing such concrete answer? That I find fascinating in Cantal.
I totally agree, and probably I wouldn't even have started this podcast if I weren't so fascinated. I guess we are almost at a crossing point, in the sense that we can either follow the chronological course of events and follow your trajectory starting from deep theoretical questions in nonlinear control, or start in a bit of an unusual way right from the present. So what keeps you busy these days? And I would probably ask you, actually, what do you prefer?
I have no preference. Of course, it's always easier to speak about the present, and that's what, you know, keeps me awake.
So let's speak about the present.
Yeah.
I think the present is a very exciting thing to talk about. At least I was reading the other day your paper on the IEEE proceedings, spiking control systems. To me, that is really a manifesto almost towards what are you going to do over probably the next decade, I believe. And I really liked one quote where you say explicitly, "We aim at developing a control theory of spiking systems, which will apply both to the natural world of biophysical neuronal circuits and the post-digital technology of event-based systems." I think that sentence is a masterpiece, and it somehow is transparent that you also want to inherit all the heritage from cybernetics, but moving forward, you want to incorporate new knowledge, let's say, coming from controlled systems and the mixed feedback principle that we will definitely talk about in a second. So what is your goal and your motivation, I would say, as well?
Yeah, my motivation is very clearly to focus on the importance of event-based systems and event-based control as a topic that has received, I would consider, very, very little attention in control. The name, I think, was quote and coined by Carl Astrom and his book chapter of 2007 that is called Event-Based Control. My reading of that book chapter is that itself it builds upon a paper that Carl Astrom wrote in 1991 together with Carver Mead, the father of neuromorphic engineering, and that brings the importance of events. And it's very, very defeating to talk about events and to do research about events nowadays, because our language and the language of information engineering has become so divided between the analog language on the one hand and the digital language on the other hand. And events are clearly something that mixed the continuous and the digital. And as a control theorist, I've come to regard this story as a story of mixed feedback, the positive feedback being associated to discrete states and by stability and automata and the language of digital technology, and negative feedback being associated with homeostasis, regulation, and the theory of continuous regulation. And it is only through time, and because I was studying neuroscience, and because I started reading what I was seeing in neuroscience as a theory of mixed feedback, that I became aware that, in fact, cybernetics was a science of mixed feedback. And I think many people in the community would agree that the cybernetics age was a sort of a golden age, very short-lived golden age of control, and that nowadays there are many signs that we are sort of returning to that age, but much better equipped, because in the meantime, we have developed fantastic tools that we can now use to reconsider questions that perhaps were ahead of their time. But definitely, my view is that the digital age created this strong separation between between positive feedback and negative feedback, and that control theory became a theory of negative feedback, and that it is a little bit today the trap where control theory, or the corner where control theory is sitting, and that there is so much more to explore and to be connected both to biology, but also to now these fast-developing event-based sensors and event-based actuators that is opening so many new questions and new paths of research for control theorists that I find is very, very exciting. Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack in what you just said. I just want to maybe mention a couple of things for our audience, and then I guess we'll delve into some of the concepts that you mentioned so far. So first of all, I just want to mention to the audience of control theory, let's say that who Carver Mead is. Carver Mead worked with John Opfield and Richard Feynman, Nobelist, helping to create three new fields: neural networks, neuromorphic engineering, and the physics of computation, just to name a few. He founded at least 20 companies, from integrated circuits to silicon sensors for photographic imaging. So he was really a pioneering figure in the history of science. But since you were mentioning, first of all, the notion of mixed feedback or the mixed feedback principle, maybe we should try to unpack that. So what does that imply, or how can we explain, let's say, to our audience, what is the mixed feedback principle?
So the mixed feedback terminology comes from the mixed feedback amplifier that features the cover of the well-known textbooks of electrical circuits by De Zoor and Shua from the 80s. And on the cover of that textbook, you see the op amp with a wire both connect to the negative port of the, so a feedback wire, a wire connecting the output of the amplifier both to the negative port of the amplifier and to the positive port of the amplifier. And the story of the feedback amplifier that we know in control theory, that I knew in control theory, was the story of negative feedback. But historically, things went the other way around. So the first use of the op amp was the positive feedback amplifier, because that was the way to design switches in analog systems. And so until the Second World War, the only way to realize switching circuits and circuits that were not equilibrium circuits was through positive feedback amplifiers. And this makes the discovery of Black, of the negative feedback amplifier, only more impressive, that he had this vision that there could be a use of connecting the output of the op amp to the negative port, because that would make the op amp less sensitive to disturbance, less sensitive to uncertainty. And so we know that it took, 9 years for Black to get his discovery patented. And so that shows the spirit of the time, that why would you ever connect the output of a system to the negative port? And today we have just the opposite view, at least as a student. And I remember speaking to some control theorists and talking to them about positive feedback and seeing that phase that, why would you ever connect the output of an op amp to the positive port? And then the way I read any device in the body, and in particular in the brain, is a mixed feedback amplifier. And so nature somehow is making use of this mixed feedback amplification all the time. And I think for very good reasons. So yeah, this is my short story of the mixed feedback concept.
Maybe like just to help the audience grasp what it really means. So I guess it's what you're advocating is that in a feedback loop, there's always, if we're interested, let's say, in building systems that range, let's say, from the analog behavior to the digital behavior, we should mix, really have elements that both have positive feedback and negative feedback in order to be able to capture, let's say, almost all behaviors of interest. Is that fair to say? Or,
well, at least in my view, to sort of reunite the two branches of control, that are automation and regulation. So today, you know, the conferences are different, the classes are different, the textbooks are different, and you choose your side. Either you study automation through automata to the language of discrete state, finite state machines, or you study continuous control systems and the world of regulation and the world of, which is fundamentally an analog world. And I think that the best of those two worlds comes together when you consider mixed feedback. Something that was sort of, I think, very well appreciated in the 40s, at the time where of the golden age of the mixed feedback amplifier, but then somehow disappeared from the field.
I guess this is a good point where to mention how does the mixed feedback principle enter into the picture of neuroscience. So I guess we could mention some of the paradigmatic models of how a single neuron behaves. That's probably a good example.
Well, of course, the fundamental model of neuronal excitability that goes back to Hodgkin and Huxley in 1952 is precisely the model of explaining the action potential of a neuron, so the spike, as through the analogy of an electrical circuit where you attach to an RC circuit, so a passive circuit, you attach two current sources, one providing positive feedback and the other one providing negative feedback. And identifying those two current sources was the fundamental insight of Hodgkin and Huxley and is the mechanism of thresholds. And so what we, I think, the fundamental elements that we now see appearing in technology is the value of thresholds. And so as long as you use negative feedback, as long as you only consider negative feedback control, you are in the world of equilibrium systems. So you always reject disturbance and try to go back to equilibrium. The world of mixed feedback introduced this notion of threshold, that if the disturbance exceeds a certain level, you want to signal the disturbance. And you signal through an event. And that event is a spike. And that event can be transmitted, can be communicated. There is something happening. Yeah. And I find this extremely important in every behavior. And of course, we could take the example of robotics, but in fact, any single control system that you look at is just jumping from event to event. And that, again, that goes back very much to the early view of cybernetics. And I like the one of Ross Ashby in particular, who developed this concept of ultra-stability, thinking of machines as systems that switch between discrete states, like an automaton, however, each of these states being continuously regulated. And so it is sort of a mixture between an automaton and it's a regulated automaton. That is a concept that is very, very clear and present in the early days of cybernetics, but there was no theory at the time to formulate that concept. And I think that, so that has been at the core of my research, to try to now use the current theory of control to formulate what would be and how should be modeled such a machine.
Since you mentioned the notion of, you know, dynamics away from equilibrium, okay, this is just a personal curiosity. Have you ever thought about like the links between what you're studying today and thermodynamics? So something that you didn't like so much. So it seems like, at least locally, you're going against the principles of thermodynamics. You are generating order in a way. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well, I think that thermodynamics away from equilibrium, as it was developed in the 80s and very popular in the 90s, is indeed very much the analog of the way, you know, chemical reactions and which at the end those neurons are made of. So how can chemical reactions away from equilibrium generate order, generate patterns, generate? So at sort of a high conceptual level, yes, there is clearly a lot of resonance between the idea of thermodynamics out of equilibrium and the idea of control out of equilibrium. But of course, I'm not an expert of thermodynamics, but when I discuss thermodynamics out of equilibrium with experts, I hear that we are very far away from having a proper theory of thermodynamics away from equilibrium.
So it's probably too early to talk about these questions. Somebody who will listen to this podcast in the future, 50 years away from now, will have some answers, hopefully. Since you mentioned event-based systems, and I guess one of the main applications you have in mind are potentially event-based cameras, I think maybe we can dig into that. So I guess those are the applications you have in mind, probably. Is that fair to say, or is that more to it?
Well, I think that when I talk about mixed feedback, people often talk about my interest to neuroscience. And indeed, it is because of my interest in neuroscience that I became interested in mixed feedback and that I became sort of obsessed to try to reconcile theory, control theory, with the mixed feedback principle. But in the recent years, and since I sort of discovered this whole community of neuromorphic engineering and event-based sensing, it occurred to me that, in fact, even away from neuroscience, there is a huge potential of exploring event-based control. And, for instance, if you look at the book chapter of Karl Astrom on event-based control, his motivation comes from all possible applications of control, but neuroscience. So it's also a way for me to sort of go back in my home country, which is the theory of control systems, and to think away from neuroscience of the potential use of mixed feedback, of the potential use of thresholds. And clearly, we now see an explosion of event-based sensors and event-based actuators. So sooner or later, control engineers will be called to connect them together. And I think it's fair to say that at the moment, we don't have a theory to connect an event-based sensor to an event-based actuator. The way we do it at the moment is that we interface the event-based sensors with a digital processor, and then we interface the output of that digital processor maybe to an event-based actuator, and that's how we close the loop. But of course, it's very tempting to think that in some specific cases, we could short-circuit these interface and go straight from the event-based sensors to the event-based actuator.
It makes a lot of sense. Also, I guess, very trivially, potentially, just for energetic considerations. So all of the systems that you're mentioning are very much energy, what's the opposite of energy hungry? They would be not very consuming in terms of energy.
Right? Yeah, so this is one advantage that is very often put forward, especially nowadays, in the energy crisis that we experience, that event-based is also a potential solution to the carbon footprint of current technology, and in particular digital technology. When I was a student, it was the beginning of the internet, and we were really presented digital technology and digital information as a free technology, as an energy-free technology. And it's funny that 30 years later, especially after this pandemic, suddenly the carbon footprint of digital technology is making news. And everyone is sort of becoming very worried about the growing energy demand of the storing, but not just storage, but any all the devices that come with information technology. And I think that that's exactly the vision of Cavermead. And Cavermead saw that at the end of the 80s, so long ahead of his time, perhaps because he was at the very forefront of digital technology and he could foresee that this Moore's law that he formulated himself would not go forever, and that there would be a time where we would be hit by the limitation of digital technology, including the and prime and foremost, the energy demand of digital technology. And I think we are living exactly in that time.
This is a good segue for me to talk about energy, but energy from a control theoretic perspective. So very much part of your, theoretical investigations is the concept of dissipativity. And that's one of the pillars of systems theory. So maybe you can guide us through how does that intertwine with the mixed feedback principle, neuroscience, and your current obsession about monotonicity.
Don't get me started, because it would become a seminar. But yeah, it's true that I think that dissipativity is a central concept of control theory for many reasons, but prime and foremost because it describes this interaction between the external and internal that I was mentioning earlier in energetic terms. So how does the external supply of energy relate to the internal storage of energy? And I think it's a very profound way of describing how a system or how a physical system interacts with its environment. It's not the only reason why dissipativity is so important. I think that so dissipativity is a bridge, but it's not just a bridge between the external and the internal. It's also a bridge between mechanics and electricity, because it's also a bridge between the input-output description of systems and the state-space description of a system. So it is also a bridge between the heritage of electricity, where we think of circuits as interconnection of input-output devices, and the heritage of mechanics, where we think of systems as determined by, let's say, Newton's law and governing the motion from an initial condition. Dissipativity really interconnects those two worlds, generalizing the Kalman-Yakubovich-Popov lemma, which is perhaps the fundamental heritage of our field. And this bridge is not just a bridge between physics and analysis, between input-output and state space. It is also a bridge between physics and computation, because it is also through that bridge that linear control theory became algorithmic. It is fascinating that in the dissipativity paper of Jan Willems, the LMI and is almost mentioned there en passant, but in fact precedes by 20 years the reformulation of control theory and of every important control theoretic question as the solution of convex optimization problem. So yes, dissipativity is important in many ways. And then when I moved to mixed feedback, when I moved to neuroscience, I was very frustrated that somehow I could not use this theory, or I was always hoping for. I think here perhaps I have to mention how I came to connect mixed feedback to dissipativity. And this is thanks to a question from Malcolm Smith, my close colleague. I had given my TED talk in 2014 about mixed feedback and, praising the use of mixed feedback. And then I had this conversation with Malcolm, and Malcolm said, oh, by the way, how do you define negative feedback? you have to, I mean, the value of such questions is I think that most of my research comes from such questions that are sometimes asked by colleagues, most of the times asked by my students, by my postdocs. It's really through those conversations that you realize that something that you found evident and self-explanatory, in fact, is not. And that is pushing you further into digging into the question. And so how do you define? And the point of Malcolm was that defining what negative feedback is what led to control theory. Because after the invention of the feedback amplifier, very quickly people start experiencing instability with negative feedback. How could possibly negative feedback lead to instability? Aha, well, this is because the dynamics of the plan can in fact change the sign of the feedback in the loop because of the phase shift. And this leads to the frequency response and Nyquist. And so the whole heritage of control is in that question somehow. Now, through the question of Malcolm, I realized that there was something missing in connecting mixed feedback to, dissipativity, because the only way you can define the sign of a feedback loop in a nonlinear system is by thinking incrementally. So if the feedback signal is a current signal, what determines the sign of the feedback loop is not whether the current is an inward or outward current. It is whether the current source has positive conductance or negative conductance. That distinction between the sign of a current and the incremental sign of a current is something that I didn't appreciate until I started working in that area, until I started discovering how much it is a source of confusion in neuroscience and how much it is a source of confusion in control. That we, because of the heritage of the linear theory, we always tend to think of incremental quantities and non-incremental quantities as equivalents, but they are only equivalent for linear systems. And this is how I started realizing that all what I knew in nonlinear control was rooted in a non-incremental approach, including dissipativity. So the dissipativity, the definition of dissipativity of Williams is nonlinear, but it is non-incremental. That is, solutions are always evaluated with respect to the zero storage, the solution, the equilibrium solution that corresponds to the minimal storage. Instead of evaluating solutions with respect to each other. And that has indeed become a sort of an obsession to realize that we didn't have an incremental form of dissipativity theory. And for many years, I tried, and I don't think I'm the only one who tried to explain and understand why we didn't have an incremental form of dissipativity, until I sort of came up to the conclusion that, in fact, we don't have a theory of incremental dissipativity because we don't have, it's very, very difficult to think of state-space models that have incremental input-output properties. That gap is a total surprise to me. It is very much, it's very close to my current research question. And again, it is something that independently from neuroscience, independently from the particular application that led to those questions, I think is a question, is an important question for the field, is how do you define a nonlinear capacitor? And I've come to the conclusion that the classical state-space definition of a nonlinear capacitor that, for instance, was advocated by Shua, and that is rarely questioned, in fact, is problematic because it gives us a model of a nonlinear integrator that is not incrementally passive. And this whole path from dissipativity to mixed feedback and sort of back to dissipativity is to me an example of how research sort of evolves and how ultimately the only way to formulate new questions that can be extremely theoretical and fundamental is always in control driven by very concrete questions. So I would never have imagined to question the state-space model of a nonlinear capacitor unless I had been pushed to refine what I meant by positive and negative feedback and how I can sort of encapsulate these concepts that are clear to everyone because they are everyday's concepts. But if you want to turn them into a mathematical theory, you have to work hard and then you eventually discover that the theory is incomplete. I think this is the path of research in many problems in control theory.
Again, there is a lot to unpack there. It was a fantastic journey just to follow your line of thought. The first comment that I have is very curious that at the end of the day, we end up talking so much about a sign change, in a sense, or whether it's positive feedback or negative feedback. Another thing that I can extrapolate from line of thought is that, well, I'm going to quote Sherlock Holmes from Scandal in Bohemia. He says that it is a capital mistake to theorize that before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. And this is very much resonating with what you said. So it seems to me also that, yeah, we are in a situation in control theory at the moment where we very much see what Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions predicted. So there are phases in science where there is a growing miscontent with theories that in some way do not satisfy, they're not able to answer questions that we do have. And yeah, it's the last comment I have is that it's quite funny that we always end up talking, at least in the background, there is always the figure of Jan Willems kind of foreseeing the importance of so many of these questions, including dissipativity and the tension between paradigms and puzzles. So,
yeah, that's very true. And there is a lot in what you just said in a few words. I agree. And I think that it's not special to our field. In fact, perhaps this is the value of venturing in neighboring fields. So, for instance, I worked for maybe 10 years in optimization on manifolds, and was really a journey outside of my field, I would say. Had not much to do with control. Then I ventured in neuroscience, in neurodynamics, again in another neighboring community. And in all those communities, I always observed what you just described. I think it's inevitable that a topic becomes a topic because it becomes popular. And even if initially it emerged from a very concrete question, maybe after one generation, it becomes a theory that is somehow independent from the question that led to the theory. And the next generation just worked on the theory. And there is nothing wrong about that because you want to deepen the theory. The only problem is that this, by deepening the theory, you know, you create more expertise and you create a theory that is more and more detached from the original question that motivated the theory. And inevitably, eventually, this theory sort of detaches itself from reality. And at that time, I think there is indeed the danger that it becomes sort of self-referencing. But as soon as something becomes self-referencing, it dies very quickly. So I think I feel much more in peace with that phenomenon nowadays, because I think there is nothing wrong in that phenomenon. Perhaps initially I thought, oh, but my field is bad because people are going that way. I don't think it is specific to my field. I think it is specific to the mechanism of research. It just shows the importance of diversity in science. I think of all my journeys in neighboring disciplines as a sort of going into a foreign country for a while and then going back home. And to me, it has always been important to come back home because this is where I feel home. And I think it's important to have a home. But it's also by traveling that you realize, first of all, that you realize the value of your own identity. And nowadays, I think I have much higher appreciation for the value of control than I had before venturing in other fields. But it also makes you aware of the importance of diversity, because it's only by, you know, venturing and by traveling that you encounter new questions that you and this is very refreshing. This is very important. So there is indeed a tension, I think, and we have to be very careful about that tension. There is no easy answer. Otherwise, it's part of the cycle of life, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it seems almost an evolutionary process, in a sense. So theories do tend, as you say, to evolve on their own. But at the same time, if they do that too much, they die. Yeah, I think it's super interesting, but potentially like the topic of another podcast episode. I just want to close the loop maybe on the, let's say, nonlinear control side of things, because we didn't touch on, at least in depth, on some of the concepts that I think are key and also made you win, for example, an Axel B. Prize recently on the concept of dissipativity. And maybe there, and we're talking about the concept of p-dominance for those who are not familiar with it. There will be a link in the description. And, you know, the concept of contraction, the concept of positivity, and the concept of monotonicity. So how do all of these notions intertwine, and why are they so fundamental in a way?
Okay, again, there is danger that I start a seminar here. But at the core of all these questions is, again, the difference between incremental and non-incremental. And I think it's best to start with the concept that is perhaps the most common concept to every control theory is the concept of stability, and even more so the concept of Lyapunov stability, which is a concept of internal stability, so state space concept. Lyapunov stability is non-incremental. It is stability with respect to an equilibrium solution. The non-incremental, the incremental form of stability, of Lyapunov stability, is contraction. And contraction was introduced in our field in 98 by this paper of Slotin and Lou Miller, that I think is a turning point in our appreciation of incremental properties in the state space domain. And we see nowadays, 15 years, 25 years after this the publication of this paper, that indeed contraction has become widely appreciated. And I think that there is a wide appreciation of why contraction is important and perhaps more important in many engineering questions than Lyapunov stability. But contraction is just an incremental form, in my thinking, is just an incremental form of Lyapunov stability. Now, this is all about an internal concept of stability or a state space concept. What about the input-output concept? Input-output stability is well understood in the linear case. In the nonlinear case, the incremental form of input-output stability is an incremental gain. And there is some theory about incremental L2 gains, but a big missing bit of the control theory today is the lack of concept of incremental passivity. That brings us back to the question I was alluding to earlier. Why don't we have an incremental form of dissipativity? And so the notion of incremental passivity is very well understood in an input-output setting. If you go back to the early work of the textbooks of De Zoor and Vidyasagar, for instance, passivity and incremental passivity are treated on equal foot, I would say. But in my education, which is post-input-output theory, which is very much state-space theory, because from the 80s, nonlinear control became dominated by state-space modeling approaches, the incremental concept is pretty much absence of any textbooks of nonlinear control. So nonlinear control theory is very much a non-incremental theory nowadays. And I think it's because of the state space model concept. So my effort in revisiting incremental passivity, and that is what led me to this notion of monotonicity. What is monotonicity? It's incremental positivity. So we have, what are the notion of positivity? Or we have many notions of positivity, because when we go from scalar to vectors, and then when we go from vectors to operators, well, there are many ways to generalize the concept of positivity. Passivity is one concept of positivity out of many. And monotonicity as the incremental form of passivity is one concept of monotonicity among others. It's an input-output concept of monotonicity that I've discovered by going back to the early days of circuit theory and by discovering that the person who invented the concept of monotonicity, Minty, in 1960, was precisely trying to answer a question that I've had to answer for the last 10 years. What is a nonlinear resistor? How do you define an element with positive conductance? Here we go. That's also the value of re-studying history from time to time, is that very, very often you discover the answer to your questions. You discover that they have been previously answered, but then they have been forgotten. And so I became very interested in the input-output concept of monotonicity invented by Minty, the fact that it then became a sort of a foundation of convex optimization. So again, this bridge between physical modeling and computation is very much there, and it is there in the incremental form of passivity. It is not there in the non-incremental form of passivity, which was the topic of my first book, so of my early days in control, using passivity as a fundamental concept to, let's say, solve stabilization questions. But the nonlinear passivity concept, the non-incremental form of passivity, is a very nice concept, of course, because it retains a physical meaning, but it's not an algorithmic concept for sure. And so the fact that a negative conductance, so a resistor with negative conductance, could be a passive element, started, you know, really showing the value of clarifying the incremental properties of a device and not just the non-incremental passivity property of a device. Sorry if it is too long of an answer to your question, but
it's never too long. Yeah. Never. I guess when you refer to conductance, you mean differential conductance, or incremental conductance. That's what you conceptually visualize.
Because I think that conductance should be understood only differentially. Mm-hmm. The notion of chordal conductance or non-incremental conductance is not really meaningful. Monotonicity means that the slope of your function is always positive. But what is the meaning of positivity with respect to zero? That the graph of your function lies in the first and third quadrants. Yes, it is a property, but it's a property that has nothing to do with monotonicity, right? And I think one would agree that for most problems, the property of monotonicity would be far more important than the property of positivity, of non-incremental positivity.
I hear a lot of, let's say, resonance with one of your latest editorials on the IEEE controlled magazine's systems. I should mention that Rodolphe is the editor-in-chief of that journal. I'll put a link in the description to the journal and the editorials. The last one at this stage is about the art of the state. And it's really a campaign to almost overthrow the state space modeling and in favor of something that is more tractable and something that is also, I would say, more robust in for the purpose of algorithmic computation. Is that fair to say, you think?
I'm always sorry when I hear that I'm campaigning because against something, because it is certainly not my intention to campaign against state space modeling. To me, the value of control is precisely in bridging the state-space world of mechanics and the input-output world of electricity. So my campaign is for that bridge. Mm-hmm. It's not that we should be one-sided. And it is for that bridge because my view of control theory, or for nonlinear control theory, is that today is that it's very much dominated by state-space, so it's very much one-sided. And it's not an accident that every application of nonlinear control nowadays is in, well, I should say nearly almost application is in robotics rather than in electronics. In fact, the contact between control and circuit disappeared in the nonlinear age. So if you open a textbook on nonlinear control, there is very, very little about nonlinear circuits. And if you open a textbook about nonlinear circuits, there is very, very little about control. And my efforts to model neural systems as nonlinear circuits has pushed me to study and learn the old theory that was developed in the 70s that was all coming from circuit theory and aiming at developing a nonlinear feedback system theory inspired by circuit theory. And so if I'm campaigning for something, it's only to restore the importance of this input-output approach and the value of the bridge between the input-output approach and the state-space approach. It's not at all against of course, the concept of state-space is extraordinarily important and a very, very important heritage of our field.
Yeah, so I guess it would be more fair to say that you're campaigning to resurrect the bridge that once upon a time was so evident and perhaps these days is not so much.
Yes.
I guess, again, from here, we could take many directions. I have a couple of questions that I do want to ask you about, let's say, the implications of your research in neuroscience before maybe we move on and touch on other topics. Some of these are maybe a bit provocative and they're like the aim at fantasizing, if you want, about what can we achieve if we understand the mechanisms by which neurons or even the brain work. So the question broadly would be really, what can we achieve, say, in the next decade, 20 years, 100 years, if we push forward this concept and for example, I don't know, what can we say about perception? How is it integrated? Or is there any hope about saying something about how consciousness arises? Or
I'm not a neuroscientist, and so I don't think I'm qualified to make any prediction about the future of neuroscience. What I see through my colleagues who are neuroscientists is that there also there is a resurrection of the cybernetics age. So the whole effort of cybernetics was to think of the brain as a machine and to approach the brain. So the British father of cybernetics, Ross Ashby, was not a control theorist, was not an engineer. He was a psychiatrist. And it was part of this, it was very much at the genesis of cybernetics to approach the understanding of the brain from an engineering perspective. And then with the rise of molecular biology, neuroscience became a quantitative science, and it became very much dominated by, you know, a very scientific approach of describing the brain, describing the anatomy of the brain, describing the anatomy of the neural circuits, and understanding the neural circuits from those scientific descriptions. We see an illustration of that fact with, for instance, the emphasis nowadays on connectomics, that, you know, as if understanding the connectome of a large network would tell you how the network works. And I think that nowadays there is more and more appreciation in neuroscience that if we want to think of, if we want to make progress in understanding the brain, it's not enough to have this scientific description of the brain. We need also to understand the mechanism of the brain, and it's very valuable to approach those mechanisms from an engineering perspective. And again, there is always a balance in neuroscience and in every science between science and engineering. So in neuroscience, you have a balance between the quest of understanding the brain and the medical desire of curing diseases. Okay, and there is a tension between those two. But I think that the value of it's also that I love this claim of Feynman, who is perhaps the most theoretical physicist of our time, but saying understanding is building. So the idea that it is by building a machine that mimics the brain that we will understand the brain, I quite like that view and that approach. And so that is closer to my field, because control is about design. And to me, control is design under uncertainty. And I think this is a concept that resonates very much with the current approach of thinking of brain as producing extremely reliable functions out of huge uncertainty and sloppiness in the components. So how much, so much variability in the anatomical components of the brain can lead to such reliable brain functions? I think that's a core question of neuroscience today. That's why I think it's a control question. And I think that as a control theorist, I see this as a key question for the future of artificial intelligence and the future of robotics. How can we design intelligence machines, so machines that are closer to what we experience in natural intelligence, and deal with the uncertainty and deal with the sloppiness of the components? And I expect a lot of progress and a lot of synergy and interaction between neuroscience and control engineering along those lines.
So maybe we're going to cut this later. So you mentioned it at the outset. So we're looking forward to seeing the relationship between control and neuroscience condensing in your upcoming book with Guillaume Drion and Alessio Franchi, whose title is, if I remember correctly, Neuromorphic Control Principles. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
We're looking forward to that.
Yeah. You know, there are many, many books out there that are half written. So we will see whether this book belongs to the category of published or never published book. But I do think that this book will... there are two reasons why you can write a book. You either write a book because you want to learn a topic, or you write a book because you are an expert on a topic. I like very much, I think it's Vidyasagar who once told me that... if you want to learn about a topic, write a book on that topic. There is no better way of learning than being forced to explaining concepts. Yeah.
And again, we go back here to the tension again between teaching and researching, which is very much intertwined, I would say. I guess this is a good time to shift gears a little bit. And I mean, there's a number of questions that I like to ask to our guests. But first, I would like to maybe dig into, I would say, something like that I would call a double life almost that you lived. So you had time to explore optimization on manifolds in a book that potentially, I think it's your most cited publication so far. And I remember having a conversation with you where essentially you told me that it started as a hobby almost. It started as something that a side project. Is that fair to say?
I wouldn't say a side project, but I would say as a sort of, as a journey. So it is a side project as you would decide to visit a country for a while and then come back. And perhaps it's the first time in my career where I sort of venture into a neighboring discipline because, yes, control is very much a science of optimization and a science of feedback. But I think that optimization is not specific to control. Optimization is somehow a driving paradigm in many disciplines. So also having ventured in optimization for a while and having come back to control, I now consider that out of the two, feedback is really what is the distinctive feature of control theory. And that control theory exists as what it is, because it addresses, I think it's the only science in my view that really addressed the question of feedback at its core. So venturing in neighboring disciplines showed me the value of traveling and traveling abroad and learning another language and also appreciating how difficult it is and how time consuming it is to learn the language of another community. I used that skill later on when I decided to venture in neuroscience. So it was sort of a first step. And then perhaps realizing that by moving to a neighboring disciplines, you can potentially contribute to that discipline in a very original way, not necessarily being more clever than your peers, but having these different insights that comes from the diversity I was talking before. And so, of course, I'm very glad of the success of optimization on manifolds a posteriori, because it was totally unexpected. And clearly working on that topic in the early 2000s was working on a very esoteric topic. And seeing that now this topic has become widespread in machine learning, in computer vision, and is, of course, very rewarding and to me encouraging about the value of diversity, about the value of jumping in a neighboring community and saying, okay, this is what matters in my field. Do you think it might be of relevance in your field as well? And in that case, it was the role of invariance. You know, we put a lot of attention to invariance properties when we do physical modeling in control, and the geometric thinking in control is very much rooted in an effort to formulate questions in a sort of coordinate-free manner, and so in ways that are invariant as much as possible. And approaching the design of optimization algorithms with this particular angle was not common at all, certainly at the time. And of course, it's of great relevance in a number of engineering disciplines where, let's say, you want to computer vision algorithms to be invariant to the motion of the camera or things like that. We can think of many problems where invariants are of tremendous importance. And to me, that's what I learned from my journey in optimization, that by venturing in a neighboring field, well, first of all, it's very challenging because you have to learn a new language. Second of all, perhaps the way you can contribute there is by using your own identity and using the diversity that you are bringing in a different community. And so I became sort of more confident that indeed diversity is something very rewarding in science and very important in science.
Again, there's a lot of meat to unpack there. You're indirectly addressing one of the questions that I would have asked you before, actually later, about advice to future students, potentially. Another thing that you touched on that I think is important is the relevance of conceptualizing almost in a representation-free manner, if that makes sense. So that is something that is very much at the core also of much of the research of Jan Willems in the field of systems theory. So this is actually one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, and maybe then I'll try to close the loop on optimization on manifold. But would it be fair to say that he was one of the most inspiring figures for you? And if you had to name three, who would they be? I know it's a tough question and it will definitely be do injustice to some.
Yeah. Well, there is no question that Jan Willems would be one of the three, and that I think it is his research that has been perhaps most influential on my research in exactly what you were saying, in the importance of questions and the importance of formulating a question in a mathematically precise. So this tension about picking your questions out of conceptual questions, like what is positive feedback? It's a very conceptual question. But then turning that conceptual questions into something that is that becomes mathematically precise, I think that the research of Jan Willems in that regard is really remarkable. And I have no doubt that it will be a long-standing heritage for the field for that reason. If I have to think of other names, well, clearly I would mention my mentor, who is Peter Kokotovich. And Peter Kokotovich influenced me in a very different way than Jan Willems. It's not so much the research, I think, that influenced me, but the attitudes towards research. And probably that today, when I have to make a decision about what to do, what not to do, how to do something, the person that most frequently comes to mind is Peter Kokotovich. So what would have he done in this situation? What would have been his advice? And it is in that sense that I consider him as my mentor. He certainly taught me the value of history and the fact that you cannot understand the concept until you have unfolded the history of that concept. I find this extremely important. In science, we often have a negative vision on history, on the whole of history. So all history is looking backwards, science should look forward, and yeah, I do think that the best way to look forward is first to look in the past, what is useful to move forward and take heritage of what was known in the past. Yeah. A third name, I'm afraid would not be a name, but I would like to mention here really the role of my students and postdocs, so including you, Alberto. Because I think that, and I mentioned that earlier, that in those conversations that make you realize that you didn't formulate clearly what you thought you were formulating clearly. Those conversations are the motor of my research. And those conversations can, of course, happen with colleagues and with anyone, but nothing replaces the role of students and postdocs in my experience in that journey. So because with a postdoc or with a PhD student, you develop a sort of a relationship over a number of years. And so this conversation over time becomes very intimate and really pushes you to the heart of the matter in a way that is unmatched, I think. So again, the value of teaching and mentoring as the motor of research, it is something that is very much part of my identity, I think.
That's fantastic. Again, you keep on serving me assists about how to proceed forward. And it's always difficult to choose because there's so many avenues that are interesting. So I mentioned earlier that I wanted to close the loop with optimization on manifolds, and we mentioned the value of history as well. So I think this is a good time to ask the question of pondering about the past, the present, and the future of our field and of the fields you ventured into, if you have any thoughts. So I guess the question could be phrased as, what are you most excited about in the years to come? What are the technologies that we should look for? And yeah, what are the questions maybe that systems and control theory should address?
Okay, I think that it's probably clear from what I discussed before. I'm very excited by the role of cybernetics right after the Second World War. I'm very puzzled by the fact that this period was so short-lived, and that somehow the publication of the book Cybernetics was the end of the cybernetics age. Because of information theory and because of the invention of the computer that put an end somehow to the needs of thinking of machines and animals in the same framework. I think we are returning to the cybernetics questions, and I think that this will occupy a lot of researchers, not just in control, but also in control in the future. I think that we have reached a stage where we see the limitations of machine learning. We have reached a stage where we see the limitations of digital technology. And we see that the limitations of those two extremely successful developments of the second half of the 20th century, that the limitations of those technologies comes from the uncertainty and come from the difficulty of handling and coping with uncertainty. So this is a perfect age for control. And I think that control will have, in my view, control has a very glorious future ahead. First of all, because it's a very young science. I keep thinking that control became a science after the Second World War, so it's very recently. And that success of control is really designed under uncertainty, as I've said before. And we have no shortage of engineering and technological challenges where we have to cope with uncertainty. But of course, we have to pay attention to what is happening, and we have to pay attention to how we can contribute to what is happening. And in that regard, I have come to regard the question of feedback as really the core question of control theory. And I think that nowadays, perhaps a lot of research in our community has moved away from the core question of feedback, has also perhaps moved away from the question of uncertainty because of the prevalence of optimization and machine learning and the fascination of what you can do with the digital computation. And again, don't take me wrong, it's not that I would want to campaign against that, but it is that I think that the future of control is in identifying that the way we can contribute to this field and to engineering in general is really by our unique way of approaching the question of uncertainty and how we cope uncertainty and how we can, thanks to feedback, turn very uncertain devices into certain functions.
This is a very fascinating picture of the future in a way, which again keeps on serving me assists about questions that I have for you. And one that I tend to ask to every guest here is about advice to future generations. So if the question could be phrased as like, what are the most important traits that successful researcher in our field should have? Or is there anything that you wish you knew something about, say, when you started your career? What sort of advice could you give to future students in control? It's a very open-ended question, and it could be also like, what should they invest on, for example?
Right. Perhaps what I would answer that it's not so much the what that matters, but the how and the why. And so I think you can, at least for a long, even in the PhD, there is this tension between research and education. You do a PhD, I often tell my students, maybe I told you that before, what I learned in my PhD is how not to do research. And perhaps this is the most important skill that you need to develop at an early stage of your career. Because everyone starts research with the ambition of, you know, solving new questions, identifying the important questions. But what you learn by doing research is that the difficulty is not to find difficult questions. There are plenty. The difficulty is to respond. The difficulty is to resonate with a question of your time and to develop skills that eventually will give you a competitive advantage or a unique angle of attack to address some questions. And that happens, again, as in the same way as I was talking about the trajectory, that happens through a sequence of events. And I think that the events themselves are not that important. It's really that you have to learn how you respond to events, and you have to find your own identity in the way you respond to events. And yeah, of course, ultimately, the advice comes from Socrates, gnotis eoton. Once, if you know yourself, if you know your limitation, if you know what you can do well, you will do well. And perhaps that's the most important question that we need to learn at an early stage of our career, is to try to learn something about ourselves.
Maybe the last question I have before closing this episode relates to something that I'm thinking about a lot these days, and that's the concept of creativity. I think you're one of the most creative persons I've met so far in my life.
Wow.
and so I have a question for you. I mean, I'll start with maybe a quote from David Bohm. He's writing the following in Wholeness and the Implicate Order. He writes, "One prerequisite of originality is clearly that a person shall not be inclined to impose his preconceptions on the fact as he sees it. Rather, he must be able to learn something new, even if it means that the ideas and the notions that are comfortable or dear to him may be overturned." And this is something that seems to very much resonate with what you were mentioning before. So I guess the question would be here, is there anything, any sort of advice that you can give to generate creativity?
Well, you are very generous, and I'm not sure I would identify myself as someone particularly creative, but I love this quote of Daniel Barenboim, who is a great pianist, and he says, "Music teaches us the difference between freedom and anarchy." And I think that scientific creativity, very much like creativity in art, is a very fine balance between constraint and imagination. And it seems to me, but perhaps this is personal, that it is the most constrained type of art that leads to the biggest creativity. So for instance, I don't think there is a stronger illustration of that than the music of Bach. The music of Bach is almost mathematical in a way, in the sense that it obeys such strict rules. How comes that throughout centuries, it generates so much emotion, including in people who, you know, who have no musical education, who don't know about the constraints? And I think that in our field, again, we are back to the fact that control is at the same time a very mathematical science, but a science of something very concrete. So I think that the best creativity that I see in control is the one very much constrained by mathematics and by the rules of mathematics. And how you find a place for novel, for innovation in those rules is a bit of a mystery. And this is where the concreteness of the environment plays its role. So the pianist who creates emotion from a piece of Bach might create emotion today and totally fail tomorrow. He might create emotion in you today, not in me, and tomorrow in me and not in you. So it's always about, and I think pianists would tell us that, it's about a resonance with the public. This resonance is really two-sided. It's not one side, so you don't have entire control on it. But you are the one who know the constraints, who have to operate under the constraints. And somehow by acknowledging that those constraints are a prerequisite for emotion and for that will happen in a somewhat uncontrolled way, perhaps I would think that this is a very important, at least part of creativity. So creativity is much more than that, but it is an element of creativity that has always fascinated me, because I find that research in control in particular is very constrained. You know, sorry to again talk about feedback, I cannot help, but constraining a concept like feedback with mathematics, you know, seems like you are... Why do you do that? What is the value of constraining such a beautiful concept with the rules of logics? And that is exactly the mystery of science and art, I think, that it is because the concept is not enough. It is the communication of the concept that is as important as the concept. And the communication uses those constraints.
So
communication in science uses mathematics as a channel. Okay. And this channel is indispensable to communicate and to exchange about the concept of feedback that creates emotion in you and me, but definitely a different one in you and different in me. And if we don't have this mathematical language, we never know whether what we express about the concept is indeed resonating with what your interlocutor thinks of the concept. Sorry if this is too long of an answer.
It's absolutely not. I mean, it's very much resonating with, I guess, with Galileo. So the world is written in the language of the universe is mathematics. Since we're talking about creativity, I mean, there is abundant evidence that shows that one thing that seems to stimulate creativity is walking. And I know you're an incredibly avid hiker. So in closing the episode, I thought it would be nice to ask you, what is on your to-do list there? Like, is there anything that you have planned?
Well, there the list is too long to be closed in one lifetime. So I hope my legs can bring me to a lot of new paths. I must say that, and perhaps this has been a consequence of the pandemics, that I've discovered that walking 10 miles from home can create the same emotion as walking on the other side of the planet. So maybe, you know, when I was younger, my to-do list includes a very famous treks and very challenging ones. But I've come to appreciate that it is the activity of walking that is wonderful, and that very often, and certainly in my case, I'm lucky that I don't have to walk very far from home to find wonderful landscapes and to enjoy walking. So I hope I will walk as much as possible and in the future and for as long as possible. But I don't care too much where I will walk, to be honest. But definitely, I agree that there is something quite fascinating about walking, also for a control engineer, because we try to build walking machines. And I also wrote an editorial about RIDM recently, and RIDM are definitely a very, very important aspect of animal machines, and walking is a very important activity. And I recently heard a very, very interesting conversation on the theme of walking between a philosopher and a neurophysiologist. And so the question was, is walking thinking or is thinking walking? That resonates a lot with me as well, that certainly most of my thinking is while walking in my personal experience. But it is also a fact, and this was the point of the neurologist, that in fact, the more we study the brain, the more we tend to think of the activity of thinking very much as we think of the activity of walking and of, in fact, any other rhythmic activity of the body. So the rhythmic nature of thinking, I think, is of great importance. And again, a natural place for control.
Yeah. So again, this is super fascinating. In what we just mentioned is very much resonating with one of your latest editorials, Clocks and Rhythms, again on IEEE Control Magazine. There will be a link in the description. Unfortunately, we are at the end of our episode. It's been a wonderful journey, Rodolphe. Thanks for featuring on the show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me here. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. I hope you liked the show today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, support on Patreon or PayPal, and connect with us on social media platforms. See you next time.